Andy Daynard is back on the show with me today. Andy and I have had many conversations over the years about reality TV. He's really the only journalist I know who's been covering the genre of reality TV on an ongoing basis for right back to the days it started with Survivor in 2000. So we're now into our 16th year of this level of reality TV. Now at the point where there are not just a few dozen, but hundreds of reality shows across all the various channels available to us in our cable and satellite world. He wrote a piece on his website, Reality Blurred, yesterday about a CNBC show called The Prophet, which I know he's been a fan of for a while. I kind of just discovered this show about a year ago, and I've been watching it. If you're not familiar with The Prophet, there's a guy by the name of Marcus Lemonis who buys into small business America. A lot of them are mom-and-pop operations, and they contacted him because they're in trouble and they need an infusion of money and maybe some sort of help. It's not the kind of thing that you see on Shark Tank, where you're getting a billionaire like Kevin Leary or you know, Lori Grenier or some of the others involved as kind of an advisor. Marcus goes in and kind of has a hands-on approach. And I've been very impressed by watching these shows, and I know Andy has too. So with that having ended last night and Survivor kicking off its new season tonight, I've invited him to return to the show today to talk about it. Hi, Andy. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Good to talk to you again.
So the Prophet is a success for CNBC, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it's pretty much been their number one unscripted show and given them a lot of confidence, and they've added a bunch of other shows around it that are kind of similar, although not quite as good. But yes, it's performing quite well, and they've even ordered a spinoff now of the show for this summer.
Yeah, we're going to get to the spinoff in a second, but tell me, and tell our listeners who may not be familiar with the show, what it is about the Marcus Lemonis Prophet that you enjoy so much.
Well, back when it first aired, I sat down with Marcus after watching the first episode or two, and what was most remarkable to me is how opposite of these other kind of business makeover shows it was. It wasn't very slick. It wasn't him running in and screaming obscenities at people and then putting some paint on the walls and then leaving.
You're talking about Gordon Ramsay right there.
Exactly, yeah. It's Gordon Ramsay, you know, Bar Rescue, John Taffer, those kind of shows. And when I interviewed him, he was very much telling me that he just was clear from the beginning that he wasn't going to fake anything, he wasn't going to do stuff for the camera, that this is his real life, this is what he actually does, and he's just going to go in and, you know, write a check and do a handshake deal, essentially, and help these companies pull themselves up and become more of a success.
What's interesting to me is that this season, they are including episodes where he goes and talks to the owners. You know, they've written to him and kind of pleaded for his help, and he has gone in there and sat down and or taken a walk through their factory or whatever their business is and talked to them. And at least two times this season, he's either not made an offer or made an offer, and the business owner said, nah, we're good.
Yeah. And I think that's what's really remarkable about it. And it also doesn't seem like, you know, that they're just doing that for publicity or something. Shark Tank has dealt with this a little bit, and they kind of talk about it on the air sometimes that people go in and just want the advertisement. But, you know, one case we saw someone at a flower shop in San Francisco, and he really wanted to get in, and she was really hesitant to structure the deal in the way that he wanted to, and they went back and forth. And it was just interesting because you were watching real negotiations and really seeing, you know, how this would play out, even if the cameras weren't there. And it ended up just being that they couldn't come to terms. And so, you know, he wished her the best, and that was it. And that was like halfway through an episode, which is another thing I love about the show. It's so unpredictable, and you can just, you know, it's not going to stretch out an hour if it doesn't have an hour, and something else will happen after that.
Now, in a lot of cases, as you know, if it's a reality TV show, if they got to that point where the business owner said, nah, I'm not going to make a deal, they would have said, well, we're making a TV show here about a deal being made and Marcus getting involved in your business, so if you don't make a deal with us, you're not going to be on TV. But the Prophet puts them on anyway.
Exactly, yeah, and I think that's, you know, to its credit as both a show that has some integrity and just as a show that really does stay true to the reality of the business world. And, you know, you could totally see this happening in other shows where they'd be like, let's just pretend, you know, that there was a deal made or that it fell through or something, but it doesn't do that.
And by the way, that does happen on Shark Tank with some regularity, doesn't it?
Which deal is falling apart?
Well, they make a deal on TV. Mark Cuban agrees he's going to put in $250,000 into this company. But then, after the cameras are turned off, the deal either falls apart or never really gets going.
Exactly, yeah. That happens in a period of what's called due diligence where, you know, they actually, Mark Cuban and his team or whoever invests, will dig into the books and the financials and make sure that all the claims made were accurate. And definitely some deals fall apart during that time and never come together. Although, from my conversation with the Sharks, it seems like the deals they make on the show fall through far less often than deals they make in real life. So it seems like Shark Tank actually does help them get, you know, better return.
All right, back to the profit for a second. What was the episode this season with the candy company, or maybe it was a marshmallow company?
The marshmallow company, 240 Sweet, I think, if I'm getting that correct.
And this was weird because it wasn't that they didn't want him to come in there and make a deal. They wanted Marcus's money, but the two women who owned this company, either they were at odds or they were just using Marcus, right?
Yeah, so they had one of their fathers, one of them with their father shared the space with them, and his equipment was kind of overlapping with theirs, and he was packaging spices, and so the flavor of the spices was getting into the marshmallows.
Oh, yeah, I remember he did something with mustard seed, and all of a sudden the marshmallows smelled like mustard and all
exactly.
sorts of other harsh spices.
It was terrible, and so they basically, you know, helped move that guy out and moved in a bunch of new equipment to do better stuff with the marshmallows, and Marcus sort of went away for a while because they don't film the show in just like 3 days and leave. It's filmed over several months, kind of dipping in and out, and he came back and basically discovered that what they, you know, had done was just sort of use him to help get the dad out of there and used his money to buy that equipment. And he said on Twitter that he's $100,000 in the hole on that and he may never get it back. But I guess that's sort of the price of not necessarily doing the show, but just investing and in a way that he does, which is really kind of on a handshake deal sometimes.
What's interesting to me is that these are investments with his own money. I mean, he's that $100,000, he wrote a check from his own account. That wasn't TV money, right?
Absolutely, yeah. There's nobody fronting him the money. It's not like CNBC is paying him behind the scenes. Just, you know, and that's the one thing it shares with Shark Tank and that pulled over was that this really is his money. And I think that adds to the consequence and just makes it feel, you know, all the more real because sometimes he gets burned. But, you know, I guess that's what happens when you're a billionaire investor and you're throwing some money around and sometimes you lose it.
What I love is watching the show and trying to decide how quickly I can figure out which crazy brother-in-law or other family member is going to screw things up. There's always one because they're all mom-and-pop operations.
Yeah, it really does feel like that the shows that either reach out or maybe just small businesses that are in trouble are, it's always just like one person who's like, you got to get this person out of the way,
yeah.
And then you'll be fine.
Yeah. It's like the producer calls up and says, yeah, we think we'd like to have Marcus come out there, but first, do you have a crazy brother-in-law? Because if you don't, we're not coming.
Exactly. I think maybe they'll do a spinoff like The Profit Family Dinners where we see this dysfunction play out even more.
Yeah. Now, you said that there's going to be a spinoff of The Profit next season. What's that?
So it's called The Partner, and they're going to start alternating seasons of The Profit and The Partner. And basically, just like the actual show, it comes directly from real life. I talked to Marcus about this, and he said basically that, you know, the way the show goes, because it is real life and he's investing in them, he can't just keep both producing shows and adding companies to his portfolio because there's, you know, eventually going to be a breaking point. So he's had to start bringing people on to his team to manage some of the properties that he's invested in. So he decided just to turn that process into a TV show, which I think is naturally going to be sort of compared to The Apprentice, but he told me that he really welcomes that comparison because it's not going to be like The Apprentice. He's not going to fire people at the end of an episode. He's going to have, you know, six or seven candidates. They'll be around for the entire six or seven episode season, and somebody might decide to leave, or he might decide that, you know, it's not really working out, but at the end of it, he'll pick up somebody, and they'll come on board his company and perhaps appear in future seasons of The Profit as they're working with the companies that he's already invested in.
Yeah, he says it's not going to be like The Apprentice, but 10 years from now, when he runs for president and goes around the country spewing crazy things, you're going to take your words back, Andy.
If that happens, I don't know what I'll do. I just put my head down and cry.
All right, let's move on to Survivor. I've only got a couple minutes, but we don't even know much about this season, which is kicking off tonight, other than it's brains versus brawn versus beauty again.
Correct. And it's everything that we've seen so far, Jeff Probst talking to the media, the trailers, the previews, all of it is focusing not on the game or strategy, but on the conditions and the three medical evacuations that we know happened because it was such severe weather in Cambodia when it filmed about a year ago, actually. So I'm worried that it's going to be, you know, we had such a great strategic season last fall,
yeah,
that this is going to be more about, like, people getting hurt and injured and that kind of stuff, which might be kind of a letdown.
Do we know any of the people who are on this? Are there returning survivors?
There's no returning survivors, but there are people we know. Those who have watched other CBS reality shows will recognize Caleb from Big Brother, who, if you'd seen that show, you would not consider him a strategic or intellectual mastermind. So that will be interesting. Also, there's a former NBA player, Scott Pollard, on the show.
Okay.
And a professional poker player whose name I'm forgetting. But a couple people like that who are sort of minor celebrities. But I think, you know, it'll be interesting with the three tribes and, you know, Jeff Probst basically arbitrarily divides them up by these categories and then pretends all season that, like, the only smart people are on the brains tribe and whatever. So I'm a little worried about that being so forced.
They're dipping back into the poker well, huh? Because, you know, Vanessa Russo almost won Big Brother, and Jean-Robert Ballande carried his big gut around shirtless on Survivor. And
exactly. Yeah, I think they see a pretty good, like, similarity with poker players and Survivor contestants, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely a connection there. All right, I've only got 30 seconds. Why do you hate The Amazing Race this season?
I have actually not watched, so I hate The Amazing Race because it's become for me the same show every episode with nobody like changing or growing. It's always the same one note over and over again, and I wish it would just slow down a little bit. But since they cast all social media stars who are people who really didn't need a national audience like this anyway, I think that they're just getting a little desperate, and that's a reason to kind of be sad about the direction it's gone in.
I like one of the things you put on your site, which was that these social media stars have a cumulative audience of 21 million people on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, etc. If only The Amazing Race could get half of them to watch, but they
exactly
don't.
And basically none of them did watch, at least according to the ratings for last week, so stay tuned. I'll have a story up about that in the next week or so, but it just looks like people aren't following social media stars from online to television.
Andy Daynard from Reality Blurred, always a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for coming back on today.
Thanks so much, Paul. Have a good one.
I'm Paul Harris. This is the Big 550 KTRS.